Attention all Podbean, iTunes, Stitcher, and TuneIn Radio listeners. The Odd to Newfoundland Paranormal Podcast brings you the best in East Coast esoterica on the first of every month. Together, we can keep it growing by sharing the show on social media, subscribing to the show wherever you may be listening to it from, and by leaving feedback about your favorite episodes. John certainly needs a friend like you to help make his dreams come true, minus the alien abduction dreams. That is not cool at all. The Odd to Newfoundland Paranormal Podcast. Always available. Always free. Always odd.
The following podcast is brought to you by Newfie EVP, Talking with the Dead in Newfoundland. Jump on Amazon.ca today and get your free sample of the best-selling ebook in Unexplained Mysteries.
It's the odd to Newfoundland. Ghostly greetings from your host, Jonathan. Mysteries, ghosts, monsters, and lore. East Coast esoterica and so much more. If it's up to you, friend, it's on the up to Newfoundland.
Ghostly greetings from the oldest city in North America. I'm your host, John Mallard, bringing you the best in East Coast esoterica. You, my friends, have stumbled upon the Odd the Newfoundland Paranormal Podcast for the month of November 2018. Guys, I hope you had a safe and wonderful kind of spooky Halloween. And if you never had enough treats in your bag, I got one more thing for you. Let me just reach into my little goodie bag here. Let me see if I can pull it out for you. Oh, here it is. I'd like to tell you, you're wonderful, a masterpiece, beautifully made, important to people because you're important to me. Highly favored by your creator, whether that is God or by the law of averages and physics working in tandem, you're thirsty for knowledge and addicted to wonder. You, my friend, are an oddball, and here on this show, you are family, and we are one. Guys, this is episode 61 of the Odd Newfoundland Paranormal Podcast, your monthly paranormal variety show. Thank you so much for taking the time to subscribe, like, comment to the show, wherever you're to, whether you're on Spotify, iTunes, Stitcher, I mean, the list goes on and on. You can always subscribe and put me on your list, because let's be honest, I'm not the most important thing in your life, and it's pretty easy to forget about me, since I only do a show once a month. But, you know, sometimes we have bonus content, sometimes we have extra shows. We actually had one this month. We had one, a Halloween meditation with Betty Collins. And that's actually gotten some pretty interesting feedback. People love that. Obviously, I don't recommend listening to that while you drive because it will put you to sleep. Awesome meditation. Check that out. That's bonus episode 60 of the Odd Newfoundland Paranormal Podcast. As well, there will be another bonus episode coming around mid-November. It will be from the open mic, ghost stories that I did at Marjorie Muse Library, where some brave souls came out just a little while ago and told their very own ghost stories, and always fun to engage the public that way, and it got a great response. Before I dive in, I just need to say that, you know, I do have some bad news. Unfortunately, my father has gone into hospital, and I don't want to go long about this or go into great detail, but what I will say is my family, and him in particular, would be very appreciative of any prayers and positive energy you can send his way. So thank you so much for taking the time. And, you know, I'm with the show, of course. I wouldn't miss this for the world, even though right now my heart is a little bit broken and I'm very, very worried. I will still perform. I will still give you the Odd to Newfoundland Paranormal Podcast in all its entirety. And speaking of the Odd to Newfoundland Paranormal Podcast, changes are coming. Where Stewie Griffin would say, treachery's afoot. Guys, some changes are coming to the show. Much needed ones. We've decided to scrap the MUFON minute, but fear not. Dr. Laura will now have her own, actual part of the show. Now her own, I like to think the MUFON minute was great, but it needed to be changed up a little bit. A breath of fresh air, if you will. She has her own segment now that is just such a beautiful reflection of her personality, which is weird science, that we're going to call Dr. Laura's Lair. And I think you guys are going to really, really like this. It's going to debut right here on this episode a little later in the show. Of course, we'll still have Betty Collins doing her Wisdom of the Oracle. That'll be coming up as well. Another thing we're also going to be scrapping is oddities. The reason why I'm getting rid of oddities is because I feel like Laura's segment is kind of going to cover that stuff. And I kind of cover that stuff in the paranormal news anyway. So there you go. So long, MUFON Minute. So long, oddities. Hello, paranormal news. Dr. Laura's Lair. Wisdom from the Oracle. And of course, a special guest every single month. Guys, trust me on this. Give the show a chance. I think you're going to like the changes we made. And, you know, it's nice to freshen things up every now and then. I guess you're sick to death of hearing about Halloween. The two spooky, scary episodes I put out, Demons and Familiars, as well as The Devil is Real, were very, very popular. They've garnered a lot of hits. But reality of it is, this is November 1st. It's time to move on. And when I think of November, I think of, you know, Remembrance Day. We're getting into that Christmas season starting to come upon us. And what better way to, you know, acknowledge people than to actually give you guys some military stuff tonight. And, you know, that'll be coming in Dr. Laura's Lair. So stay tuned. I think you're going to really enjoy it. Now, I would like to dig in with the Newfoundland Paranormal Podcast news for the month of 2018. And, you know, as you all know, Halloween has come and gone. It's time to dig in and see what happened during the crazy month of October. And the first thing that was actually brought up and brought to the forefront, in my mind, according to a new paper, a thriving extraterrestrial world could be predominantly purple rather than green. So, like, when I think of green, you know, I think of the classic green aliens.
Don't blame me. I voted for Kodos.
But, I mean, reality of it is, apparently they're all looking a little bit more like, well, Thanos.
You should have gone for the head.
I had this idea where I'd play Thanos' little part there, and after he snaps his finger, just be completely silent for the next, like, 40 minutes and see if people realize. When it comes to imagining what life on other worlds may be like, it's easy to get caught up in picturing a world not dissimilar to our own, with land masses swathed in green trees and grass. But what if extraterrestrial life was a color other than green? How would an alien world actually look like? In a recent study, two scientists attempted to answer this question by looking back into our own planet's distant past to a time when life on Earth may have exhibited a distinctively purple tinge. The organisms responsible for this, which may have thrived very early on in Earth's history, capture solar energy with a molecule called retinol. If this can happen on our own planet, then perhaps purple life forms could dominate elsewhere as well. If these organisms were present in sufficient densities on an exoplanet, those reflection properties would be printed and printed on the planet's reflected light spectrum, said co-author Edward Schweitman. Perhaps keeping an eye out for a purple alien planet is not such a strange idea after all. So there you go. It's a good chance that, you know, I'm not saying Thanos is out there, but maybe, you know, his very, very, very distant relative. Could very well be. Speaking of going for the head, everybody loves Stormbreaker, right? Well, guess what? We may have found the real thing. A rare Thor's hammer amulet has been found in where else but Iceland. The 900-year-old trinket was unearthed at the site of a Viking farmstead in Iceland's Thordalur Valley. Thor and Odin might be best known for their roles in Marvel superhero movies franchise these days, but back in the days of the Viking, these deities were taken very seriously. One notable example of their importance to the people of the time, a very rare Viking-era pendant shaped like Thor's legendary hammer, Mjolnir, was recently unearthed at a farmstead in Iceland. Ash and burnt bones, as well as wellstones and soapstone pots, were also found at the site. The artifacts have since been sent to Reykjavik for further study, and all I can say about that is, have at thee! Man. I'm telling you, you're going to blink your eyes, it's going to be Christmas, then it'll be Valentine's Day, and before you know it, it'll be Easter again. But guess what? We must talk about Easter for a second. When I think about Easter, I think about the Easter Bunny. And for some strange reason, the theme song from Dexter, as I read my next article, because there's a serial rabbit killer on the loose in France. French authorities have been hunting for a mystery killer who has so far slaughtered more than 100 pet rabbits. The culprit, who is believed to be male, has been sneaking into gardens, breaking into rabbit hutches, and killing animals either by stomping on them or by cutting them with a bladed instrument. In some cases, he has even returned to the same garden multiple times to finish the job. Authorities have noted that the culprit seems to be specifically targeting rabbits as, in some cases, other animals such as geese or chickens in the same garden have been left unscathed. The attacks began back in March and eased off for a while in August before resuming in earnest. It's hard to think it would be someone from the village, one of the authorities said. I really can't think of anyone here who would do such things. But, of course, authorities believe that the killer must have good local knowledge to have been able to so effectively locate all the rabbit hutches in the area. He also has been working to reassure residents that everything possible is being done to catch the person responsible. They're afraid they might bump into him, honestly, one of the bystanders said. And, I mean, somebody's got to say it. I think I've got the murderer pinned. I think I know who did this. I think I know who's responsible. What do you guys think? Do you think it might be this guy?
Be very, very quiet. I'm hunting rabbits.
Yeah. Wascally wabbit. Listen, October was no slouch when it came to weird stuff. Scientists have captured audio of the Antarctic shelf singing, and it sounds decidedly eerie. The low-frequency sounds, which have to be sped up for humans to hear them, are the vibrations caused by the wind as it blows across the snow dunes. The sound has actually been there and occurs constantly. The only difference now is that the scientists have found a way to record it and make it audible. It's kind of like you're blowing a flute constantly, said geophysicist Julian Chaput. The audio was captured using sensitive sensors buried 2 meters beneath the ice. Scientists are hoping that the sounds could help them to monitor the collapse of the ice shelf. An example recording of the phenomenon can be heard. Let's hear it. Let's actually hear this thing. I'm going to warn you, it's not very pleasant. Go ahead and have a listen. Not very pleasant. Ugh. Kind of sounds like an Atari thing. Oh. Isn't it just majestic? Good God, it sounds like Antarctica has got a, you know, constipated or something. And that's not the only thing to come out of Antarctica that was weird this month. Honest to God, like, just Antarctica, you were the oddest place on the planet this month. A geometric piece of ice was photographed by NASA off Antarctica's Larsen C ice shelf, and it's just, well, it's perfectly square. It's absolutely baffling. The photograph, which was posted up on Twitter this week, was taken as part of Operation Icebridge, an ongoing airborne NASA mission that aims to monitor changes in the polar ice caps. Social media users were quick to pick up on the iceberg's impossibly perfect edges and smooth, featureless surfaces, a stark contrast to the chaotic shapes and sizes of other icebergs. According to ice scientist Kelly Brunt, however, it likely formed through a relatively common process. I just said icebergs. We are Borg. Put us in your whiskey. We get two types of icebergs, she told Live Science. We get the type that everyone can envision in their head that sank the Titanic, and they look like prisms or triangles at the surface, and you know they have a crazy subsurface, and then you have what are called tabular icebergs, like this anomaly. The latter can be very flat and geometric, and typically split from the edges of ice sheets through a process that is not dissimilar to the fingernail growing too long and breaking off at the end. Despite appearances, the iceberg in the photograph is actually several miles across, and most of it is submerged under the water. The part you can't see is likely to be shaped much like a regular iceberg, I would imagine. Also, despite its flat surface, the iceberg is probably quite fragile and would break if you walked onto it. Guys, once again, I've got to say this. If there's a serial killer for rabbits, obviously it's Elmer Fudd. And if there's treachery afoot and crazy stuff going on in Antarctica that has anything to do with or snow and ice, there's only one person responsible, and we all know who she is. Probably seen that joke coming anyway. All right. One last little spooky story for you guys before we go ahead and jump into our brand new segment with Laura. CCTV video sparks ghost rumors about a restaurant. Footage recorded in Albuquerque branch of Dion Show's kitchen equipment moving all on its own. The strange incident, which was detailed in a posting on the restaurant chain's Facebook page this week, appears to have been captured on CCTV at a time when nobody else, go figure, was in the building. In the video, a metallic shelf or cover was sitting on top of the kitchen counters and can be seen suddenly moving sideways on the floor, seemingly without intervention. You guys have got to see this video. Spooky surveillance video sparks ghost rumors. And, you know, this news anchor does a really good job, so I'm going to let her have a say.
Surveillance video has many people wondering, was there a ghost at an Albuquerque Dion's? Let's take a closer look. The restaurant posted this Facebook video of its store on Morse and Montgomery. They say, look closely. We think one of our stores is haunted. It appears something falls from a counter with no one nearby. Many people have weighed in on social media saying a ghost was probably just looking for some of that famous Dion's ranch.
We had alien life being purple, you know? Pretty cool. We had a very rare, unearthed Mjolnir. Yeah, Thor's hammer amulet, which was super cool. A serial rabbit killer. Like, just picture Bugs Bunny with the Dexter theme going on in the background. We have Elsa just performing all kinds of magic in Antarctica, apparently. And we have this new ghost story. This ghost apparently was starved to death and going to this restaurant. Guys, all of these stories have been odd to Newfoundland.
And welcome to Dr. Nora's lair. Power on. I'll get the broom.
Welcome to my lair. I really appreciate the opportunity to explore the creepy, crawly, the cool corners of science with the audience of the Odd to Newfoundland Paranormal Podcast. For those who aren't actually familiar with me or my background, I've spent what feels like approximately a million years in school. I do have my master's in public health, and I'm currently working on my PhD with the Faculty of Medicine. So my particular interest is in infectious diseases, public health, epidemiology, the creepy, gross, cool stuff. So thanks for the opportunity to let me share some cool pieces of science with you. Of course, this content was curated in my personal capacity and doesn't represent the views of my institution or employer. And the content is for fun, edutainment, and maybe to inspire you to learn a little bit more on the subject areas. This time, I would like to talk to you a little bit about the origins of biological warfare. One of the earliest accounts was based on a 14th century account by the Genoese Gabriel de Mussy, in which the invading Mongol army flung infected corpses into a fortress via trebuchet in order to infect the populace. Ultimately, many felt that the Black Death reached Europe from the Crimea region as a result of this biological warfare attack. There is a really good historical review by Dr. Mark Willis of the University of California, Davis, in the Emerging Infectious Disease newsletter back in 2002, which really discussed the whole event quite nicely. So, first of all, what is the Black Death? And then, where's Crimea? So, the Black Death, or simply the plague, was one of the most devastating pandemics in human history, resulting in the deaths of an estimated 75 to 200 million people in Eurasia, and peaked in Europe from about 1347 to 1350. So the bacterium Yersinia pestis, which results in several forms of plague, is believed to have been the cause. There's been some really cool work done with whole genome sequencing recently that goes into further detail on this and does, in fact, confirm this. It is actually caused by this little bug, the Yersinia pestis, and is enzootic, which means it's commonly present in populations of fleas that are carried around by ground rodents, so like rats, prairie dogs, those type of things. And this can actually be found in various areas even today, like Central Asia, Kurdistan, Western Asia, North India, and Uganda. But there's still an occasional case every now and then available in the prairie type regions in the U.S. It's not a whole common, but it is possibly there. So there's lots of different regions, different descriptions of the plague, which are available online or medical literature. The commonly noted symptom was the appearance of buboes in the groin, the neck, and the armpits. And they oozed pus and bled when they were open. Ugh. So really gross growths and swelling. Just Google a picture. It's disgusting. So these buboes are why it's sometimes referred to as the bubonic plague. So a writer of the time said, in men and women alike, it first betrayed itself by the emergence of certain tumors in the groin or armpits, some of which grew as large as a common apple, others as an egg. From the two said parts of the body, this deadly disease soon began to propagate and spread itself in all directions indifferently. After which the form of the malady began to change, black spots or livid making their appearance in many cases on the arms or the thigh or elsewhere, now few and large, now minute and numerous, as these had been and still were an infallible token of approaching death, such also as were the spots on whomever they showed themselves. So the only medical detail that is questionable in that writer's description is that these buboes were an infallible token of approaching death, as if the buboes discharge, recovery is possible. This was followed by acute fever, vomiting of blood, and many victims died 2 to 7 days after initial infection. Freckle-like spots and rashes were also identified as another potential sign of the plague, but really could have been caused by the flea bites initially. So Ludwig Heiligen, whose master died of the plague in 1348, noted in a distinct form of the disease that infected the lungs and led to respiratory problems and is identified as pneumonic plague. It is said that the plague takes three forms. In the first, people suffer an infection of the lungs, which leads to breathing difficulties. Whoever has this corruption or contamination to any extent cannot escape, but will die within 2 days. Another form, in which boils erupt under the armpits. And the third form, in which people of both sexes are attacked in the groin. Well, buddy, you were kind of close there. Now we know a bit more, so we know that there's three types. So the bubonic and the pneumonic, which we discussed as above. But there's also a more severe septicemic plague. So this is a really full system infection and has almost a near perfect fatality rate. It's very, very traumatic when someone gets it. Now for the harder part, explaining where is Crimea. So really, it's a peninsula on the northern coast of the Black Sea in Eastern Europe that is almost completely surrounded by the Black Sea and a smaller sea to the northeast. Across the Black Sea, to the west, there's Romania, and to its south is Turkey. So this region was colonized by everyone and their dog. Greeks, Persians, Romans, Byzantines, Crimean Goths, the Ottoman Empire, the Genoese. While at the same time, the interior was actually occupied by different groups of nomads in different empires. So this include like the Scythians, the Sarmatians, Goths, Bulgars, Huns, Mongols, and the Golden Horde. So that region in Crimea were united in the Crimean Khanate, which during the 15th to the 18th century existed. Needless to say, with all these groups circulating, it was hot property and really became an active boundary between the Eastern world and the Western world. In 1783, Crimea became part of the Russian Empire as a result of the Russo-Turkish War. And that went from 1768 to 1774. So, ultimately, without going into all the crazy complicated details worth of global politics, Ukraine and Russia, and the previous USSR, had both claimed ownership. Ultimately, they now belong to Russia after a referendum. So while Russia and 10 other UN states recognize Crimea as part of the Russian Federation, Ukraine continues to claim Crimea as an integral part of its territory. This is supported by most foreign governments and a non-binding UN General Assembly Resolution 68/262. So, Black Death was far easier to explain. Crimea is very complicated, but I think now we have a general idea where it's to. So, back to the bioterrorism. Dr. Wheelis states that this is not one of the great historical interests, but also relevant to current efforts to evaluate the threat of military or terrorist use of biological weapons. Based on published translations of the De Musy manuscript, other 14th century accounts of the Black Death, and other secondary scholarly literature, he was able to conclude that the claim that biological warfare was used at Kaffa in Crimea is plausible and provides the best explanation of entry of the plague into the city. The tactics used were certainly within the technical capabilities of besieging armies at the time, and it's consistent with medieval notions of disease causality, which is truly a treat for a different day. I mean, there should also be some consideration that rodents from the military encampments may have also found their way into the city. However, this is less likely given what is historically known about military encampments at the time, and also nesting habits of our furry little friends. Ultimately, we know that infected cadavers hurled into the city could have easily transmitted plague. Contact with infected material is a known mechanism of transmission. For instance, among 284 cases of plague in the U.S. from the years 1970 to 1995, for which a mechanism of transmission could be reasonably inferred, 20% were thought to be actually by direct contact, so this checks out. According to Wheelis, such transmission would have been especially likely at Kaffa, where cadavers would have been probably badly mauled by being hurled, and many of the defenders probably had cuts or abraded hands from coping with the bombardment. It wasn't a great, clean situation. So very large numbers of these cadavers were possibly involved, greatly increasing the opportunity for disease transmission. Since disposal of the bodies of victims in a major outbreak of lethal disease is always a problem, the Mongol forces may have used their hurling machines as a solution to their mortuary problem, in which case many thousands of cadavers could have been involved. De Musy's description of, quote, mountains of dead might have been quite literally true. Based on published translations of the De Musy manuscript, other 14th century accounts of the Black Death, and these other secondary scholarly literature, Wheelis confirms that the claim that the biological warfare was used at Kaffa is plausible and does provide the best explanation of the plague into the city. As such, this appears to be one of the first biological attacks recorded, and among the most successful of all time. The theory is consistent that the technology of the times and the contemporary notions of disease causation. However, he does bring up that the entry of plague into Europe from Crimea likely occurred independent of this initial event. This early act of biological warfare, if such it were, appears to have been spectacularly successful in producing casualties, although of very limited strategic importance. The city never left Italian hands, and the Mongols abandoned the siege. Maritime commerce probably continued throughout this period from other Crimean ports. Overland caravan routes to the Middle East were uninfected. Thus, refugees from Kaffa would most likely have constituted only one of many streams of infected ships and caravans leaving the region. So, the siege at Kaffa, for all of its dramatic appeal, probably had no more than anecdotal importance to the greater spread of the plague, a macabre incident in terrifying times. We know now of many historic and current horrific examples of bioterrorism and the use of biological weapons. This has been sadly so established that we take great precautions now and even have a whole field of biosafety and security to ensure the safe use, storage, and manipulations of said pathogens. Well, that's it for this time. I gotta head back to the lab to get back to work. So, Igor, come on, we need to go. I need your help. Ugh, put the cat down.
Here, kitty, kitty.
Thanks, John. And greetings from Betty, your oracle, with words of wisdom for your consideration. Today's topic is November the 11th, Remembrance Day. Remembrance Day, as we know it, is a day to honor those who have fallen, giving us our freedom in battle. But what about those who are still with us? What about our troops who keep peace all over the world every day? The people who go to other countries to help rebuild cities and indeed whole countries? How about our elderly and infirmed who are with us in care facilities and all of those who battle every day with physical and mental illnesses? Should November the 11th become a day to honor our fallen and all people and creatures who make our life brighter? And how would we do that? The Remembrance Day Parade and Wreath Laying is set aside specifically for the fallen and our forces who serve in wars. How about on November 11th, when the clock strikes 11 a.m., if every single person on this planet took their hands, placed them over our hearts, their hearts, and imagine love going to every person known and unknown who are waging or not their own private battles? How different would the world look if each and every one of us revered our elderly instead of just institutionalizing them because we can't handle it? Yes, I understand and have been in the position of loved ones having to go to care facilities, as neither I nor my family have the physical ability to care for these loved ones at home. But is that enough? What if each person who is listening tells someone who has not heard this podcast that our elderly and infirmed are now going to be supported and have a voice through us? What if we went to these same people and recorded when we spoke to them, brought some little piece of love and asked them about their lives, make recordings to always remember them? We all have very fancy phones now that can make amazing recordings. What if we smiled at every single stranger we saw? Not only on November the 11th, but every day. What if we all help to carry someone's load? I'm not talking about taking on anybody else's troubles. I'm talking about just that. Talking. Recording. Remembering. Sometimes all we need is someone to help talk us through it all. What about all those in our justice system who really are innocent but have been accused of the total opposite? If all the world came together for 1 minute on November 11th to send love out to the entire world, it blows my mind. In meditative circles, we say that when each person meditates, we affect 750,000 others. Just imagine how much love we could send to the world if, at 11 a.m. on November 11th, we each closed our eyes, put our hands to our hearts, envisioned the whole world in front of us, and just said, "I love you. I love you. I love you," to that same vision for 60 seconds. We could actually send a wave of love, a wave that could be measured by on any of those world's incredible meters. a wave of love so deep that every organism on the planet could feel it. Please, please, on November the 11th, please take part with me in sending love to this entire planet for 60 seconds at 11 a.m. Before I close, I would really like to read a poem that my daughter wrote when she was 11 years old for a Remembrance Day assembly. It's called The Ones That Died. And this is from a little girl's perspective. Remembrance Day is a day of praise, a day to think of long ago days, standing tall and feeling brave, not knowing they'd soon be in their grave. Some of them lived, but most of them died. I wish there was no war, but we have to take pride because they stood tall and brave, the ones that died. I thank you all in advance. I send much, much love this day and every day. And for more information about me and my work, you can check out my Facebook page, Betty Collins, my business page, Facebook page, Betty Collins eFactor, as well as my under construction YouTube channel, eFactor Meditation, Calm and Peace. I can be reached via email at bettyscottcollinsnlp@gmail.com or marion.rideout@nl.rogers.com. I thank you very much for listening. Back to you, John.
Attention all Podbean, iTunes, Stitcher, and TuneIn radio listeners. The Odd to Newfoundland Paranormal Podcast brings you the best in East Coast esoterica on the first of every month. Together, we can keep it growing by sharing the show on social media, subscribing to the show wherever you may be listening to it from, and by leaving feedback about your favorite episodes. John certainly needs a friend like you to help make his dreams come true, minus the alien abduction dreams. That is not cool at all. The Odd to Newfoundland Paranormal Podcast. Always available. Always free. Always odd.
Hey guys, welcome back to the Odd to Newfoundland Paranormal Podcast. We are now back with our guest for this month. And, you know, kind of makes you want to go to Vegas. Just reading up on this guy and all the things he's a part of. Have you ever heard of this? The Applied Precognition Project. Okay, so if you have heard about this, you're going to be really excited because you're going to be really excited that our guest tonight is actually one of the founding members of this. But anyway, the Mission Recognition Project, the mission is to publicly explore. That means out in the open, okay? No more behind closed doors. Research and apply logic and intuition / emotion to predict, get this, future event outcomes. Yeah. Yeah, I'm going to say that again. Future event outcomes, enabling participants to evolve personally while contributing to the elevation of global consciousness. To some of us, that doesn't make a whole lot of sense, but to me, that makes great sense because I'm into the paranormal. I'm into the wild. I'm into the different. But is it possible for us to predict future outcomes? Is it possible for us to share information without actually opening our mouths? Is there something to remote viewing? Well, tonight's I'm just absolutely blessed to have this guest tonight. He's a firm believer, okay, that there's life after death based on his work with precognition and retrocausality that comes from his quote-unquote soul that lives forever outside of space-time. You know, how can I not have this guy on my podcast? Ladies and gentlemen, one of the founding members of APP, Applied Precognition Project, Mr. Marty Rosenblatt. Marty, how are you tonight?
I'm doing well, and thank you for that intro, John.
Oh, you know I got really excited. I can't help myself when I know there's somebody out there who's dumping so much time and research into, you know, a mostly taboo subject. And just thanks so much for coming on. I know the fans of this podcast are going to absolutely love this. I got to ask, Marty, where did this even start? Like, my goodness gracious, so many years of research. Where did this all begin for you?
Well, I guess you can even say as a young kid, I was really into science fiction. And science fiction writers often would talk about these weird things like precognition. And it always was just attractive to me, the idea that could you really get information from the future? No, they must be all lying. You know, you'd hear all these stories. And then when I became a working scientist, I had contacts with the Defense Intelligence Agency, and I went to them with this article that was done by the guys at Stanford Research Institute, where they did a scientific study on remote viewing. In fact, they invented the name. This was in the early 1970s. They invented the name remote viewing because they couldn't call it psychic phenomenon. You know, you couldn't be working on psychic phenomenon in the government. That's probably still true, except for, who knows, some programs. But in any case, there was a paper. It was the first time I ever saw a scientific paper where they actually went to where they got odds against chance of the remote viewing transcripts generated by their people would be accurate at odds of like one out of a million. And they also referred to precognition in there. And this was something that was actually published in the IEEE. So then DIA actually sent me to meet these guys, Hal Putoff and Russ Targ at Stanford Research Institute. And that was sort of when I became involved as a scientist as opposed to just general interest. But then it was quite a few years later, maybe 15 years later, until I started actually working this. I had a company called Physics Intuition Application, and it actually worked with people, taught them how to do this. It's applied remote viewing. We call it associative remote viewing. And I even used to pay people to do it because it works. We have so many statistics. Other people have done it. Precognition is no longer in the area of, is it real? Yes, it's real. It's not real all the time. Nobody can do it all the time. Even the best precoggers, the best remote viewers are well above chance in terms of how often they get the correct answer, but not all the time.
Very, very interesting stuff. You know, APP has groups, of course, that are involved.
Mm-hmm. Right.
And one of them, of course, consists of several groups that use ARV. Okay. So it's remote viewing, correct? A quick definition of actually what is remote viewing for anybody out there who might not be savvy to the subject like me and you.
Yeah. Remote viewing is basically the ability to gather information at a distance where distance is space and or time. So that includes the future, from a distance, not using your normal senses. So obviously when I get information in the future, I'm not using my normal senses. But also there's been a lot of work where they found hidden things. A guy named Stefan Schwartz has written a lot of books. He found he ran an Alexandria project. It was distant. Unknown, knew it was missing, and he used remote viewing to find it. What we do is add to the remote viewing part the ability to make predictions about, say, the way the stock market's going to move or sporting events, and this allows us to get a lot of data. We have people who are doing predictions some one times a week, sometimes five times a week. Practice actually helps.
Man, oh man. For anybody out there whose hockey team is struggling this year, such as my beloved Detroit Red Wings,
I could really use your help right now. Are we ever going to win another cup? We'll have to put together one of these groups. I just noticed that on your website, actually, and some of the things that some of those groups actually focus on are sports wagering, horse racing, Forex, stock options, lottery. There's lots of interesting things in there. That's pretty wild. And, you know, military use alone, I could see why the government might be really interested in this kind of stuff. Have you guys had any funding or anything like that? Or is this mostly a self-promoted thing?
The work we are doing has always been self-promoted, self-funded. However, we are just now starting a hedge fund with the best of the precoggers, and we will be starting a hedge fund. So there is where I do want to make money, but I really want to make it clear. I'm kind of an older person, and the money, hey, I don't mind making money. Money's potential energy. I will use it for things that are good and make me feel good. But I really want to do this so that we can educate society to the fact that their view of reality is really much narrower than the way it really is. Most people, and especially scientists, are not willing to talk about precognition. I think many of them may believe it, but they can't talk about it in our society because it's not accepted yet. A lot like your life after death stuff. It's not accepted. If you talk about it in the wrong way, you get looked at in a funny fashion. So I am with this fund, when we end up making a lot of money, that will begin immediately changing some of the financial markets. People will start paying attention, including science, will now start putting money into this to truly understand it. You know, we have rough models, but there's no really good model for how precognition works.
I think it's actually fascinating. Science has a long history of pretty much dismissing itself until proven. You know what I mean? And yeah. Like, even the most, like, I mean, I could just, one word, Aristotle. Guys, look it up if you don't know what I'm talking about. There have been people who have been held back by the realms of science for many, 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 many years, even when they are correct. And one of the things I absolutely adore about what you guys are doing is that you're taking a scientific approach. And what I mean by that is that you guys are using logic. It even says right here on your page, I gotta say this.
Yeah.
We use logic. By this we mean information processed rationally by the thinking mind. If A, then B. Example, statistical analysis. Guys, these guys are doing their homework about precognition. This is not just a bunch of guys hanging out. Like, this is an actual experiment that has scientific people behind it. And I think it's absolutely brilliant that there's so many like-minded individuals who, you know, have kind of come together for your core beliefs. I think this is awesome, Marty. I think it's awesome.
Yeah. Well, thank you. We do too, of course. So let me just add one thing since we're on to the science. I'm actually quite disappointed with science because we are not the only ones doing this. Stanford Research did it and published their precognition work. Also, there's a group at Princeton University that published their work and proved precognition. The scientific method includes always repetitions, independent repetitions. We've done all the appropriate scientific work, and yet it will not get accepted. And I think that's because it is so outlandish in terms of the way we're raised to believe that you could get information from the future. Or another way to say the same thing is that the future can influence the past. You know, our whole lives we're taught that causes come before the effects. Well, it turns out in precognition, there is a cause which is in the future, and the effects go backwards in time. Now, that's one way to look at it, which is almost the easiest to get a sense of. But the fact is it goes much deeper than that. And, you know, this might be the right time. Give me a few minutes, because I actually want to connect how deep precognition goes with why I am now a firm believer in the soul living on sort of outside of space and time, which I know is one of your interests and probably your listeners' main interest.
Absolutely. Here, in fact, I have celebrated the people who've come on my podcast who are no longer satisfied with the fact that paranormal phenomena exist. I celebrate the people who come on my podcast and try to give the explanation of how. We're no longer obsessed with the fact that, you know, EVP or electronic voice phenomena exists. We're no longer obsessed with the fact that there's life after death. We're no longer obsessed with the fact that there might be psychic phenomena out there. We are just now going to start trying to figure out how all this works and the mechanics. So, my friend, you have the floor. Go ahead.
Okay. It begins with a statement that goes back a long way, but it was specifically put together by the guys who are trying to understand quantum mechanics. Quantum mechanics is a strange kind of physics that has, you can't really understand it, because something special happens when you consciously try to measure something. And before then, it like has nothing but a probability distribution, sort of like just raw information. Then you measure it and it's in physical space. The thing they came up with is consciousness is fundamental. Okay. There's nothing behind consciousness. You can't use anything else to explain consciousness. So the expression consciousness is fundamental. And I worked it in many years. I used to work with people at the Monroe Institute and give workshops and webinars there. And they're big on out of body, but they're also big on remote viewing and higher levels of consciousness. But through there and then continuing over the years, I took this idea and it now seems to explain so much. So if you consider a universe of collective consciousness. So I've now taken the fact that consciousness is fundamental. And what do I mean by the fundamental aspect of consciousness is this now moment? Just take a second for that. What you really know for sure is this now moment. I don't know if you can hear me tapping. I'm tapping on my desk. Mm-hmm. You know? I'm looking around. You're looking at whatever. But you have that now moment. That now moment is sort of like the fundamental makeup of this universe of collective consciousness. Hey, you have memories. And what's kind of amazing is you can bring in a past memory, but guess what you're bringing it into? You're sharing it with your now conscious moment. Well, precognition is the same, except you're sharing a future memory. When the future memory comes, so we might do a remote viewing prediction of something that's going to happen tomorrow. Okay. We like to describe and sketch photographs, or places, but okay. Tomorrow, when I get there and look at that picture, that's a hidden picture, say, that is going to be my now moment, but I can share that today because this universe of collective consciousness contains all conscious moments, past, present, future, everywhere in the physical universe. So guess what? ETs, they're conscious. Your dog is conscious. There are people out there that communicate with their dogs. Telepathy is an easy one because somebody else is conscious who's across the planet, but you're both having your conscious moments that are connected through this universe of collective consciousness. So you can look at your life as a collection of conscious moments and how those conscious moments interact with other people's conscious moments. Now, without this idea of these conscious moments being there, past, present, and future, there's this idea of outside of space and time, because they're there now. There's this eternal now concept, which has been discussed in many different religious contexts.
Time for me to drop a name, someone who I love so much, who's been on my podcast, good old Thomas Fusco, the man who believes he has a working model that explains most things that are paranormal with an extra dimension of space, and that runs parallels to ours. It also talks, he also talks a little tiny bit, multiple times about how information is stored, get this, in another dimension, and it just kind of hangs there until it's ready to manifest. I just got to mention Thomas, because you touched a couple things on him, and he's been a recent guest actually a few months ago. If you don't know who he is, I'd highly recommend his book. But anyway, continue on.
Okay, but no, he's using another dimension for what I'm using as a universal collective consciousness, because we can relate to consciousness. What happens when you're doing precognition is you're getting information into your conscious mind that you then put down on a transcript. If you're using a remote viewing approach, or you can talk to a recording or something. But this ability of recognizing that consciousness, I visualize it as being a big blue circle. And then everything that comes out that you want to make separate from that. You see, this universal collective consciousness is all that is. I hate to use the word God because that brings up so much religious stuff, but that's as close as you can get, because it's everything, period. And it's all connected. It's the ultimate oneness. Now, get this, a raw idea, okay, like the color red. The color red is an idea which is in the universal collective consciousness. We experience red in the physical world and say, okay, let's call this thing red. In another language, they'll call that something else. ETs who have eyes similar to ours and see colors, they'll call it something else. But that's why telepathy works. The word itself is referring to something that's basically an idea. And this universal collective consciousness is made up of ideas. And it's something I call the subconscious. Other people might call it a higher conscious. Some people might call it their guide, angels. There's a connection between your now conscious moment and this universe of collective consciousness. That's your subconscious. Look how much your subconscious does for you. You don't consciously take care of your heart beating. You don't consciously when you walk across the street. I mean, that's actually a pretty complicated thing. It was only in the last 5-10 years that we could get robots to do it. You know, you learn to do that when you were a child. That's when your consciousness begins to take account of this physical world. But this physical world has its source in this universe of collective consciousness. It's down there where the information about quantum mechanics and how we are able to go from a pure idea state, you know, Aristotle and Plato and those guys actually talked about this sort of stuff. You know, they thought deeply about this as well. They didn't use any words like the universal collective consciousness, but they said ideas might be more fundamental than the physical world. And that seems to be the case. So I know it's not my intellect that's doing that. I am connecting with something very, very deep, which I call my subconscious, but another word for that is my non-physical spiritual side. That's what was there before I came into the physical world, and it's with me now because it does the precognition. It's certainly not my ego intellect, and then it will be with me when I pass from the physical world back to this spirit-like universe of collective consciousness. And I suspect I'm going to be consciously doing stuff in there as well, and I'll remember this life. And I'll be entangled with all kinds of other things. Some people call them other lives. I don't know. But what I do know, and this only came out of this work, is that we are so much deeper than we normally acknowledge, that it's ridiculous. And my mission now, frankly, is to educate society about that. Imagine a society where you had the physical magnificence of the intellect. Nothing wrong with the intellect. The intellect's terrific. Logic's terrific. You know, got us to the moon. It's just rather terrific. Now imagine that connected with the depth associated with consciousness itself, which is really even more fundamental than the physical world.
One of the wonderful things about the Applied Precognition Project is this website, guys. www.appliedprecog.com. That's APPLIEDPRECOG.com. AppliedPrecog.com. You guys got to check out this website. It's beautifully done. You can't miss the gigantic Pegasus. It's right on the front of there, which is their kind of like their mascot, so to speak. So, you know, I got to ask about the Pegasus now. Marty, talk to me a little tiny bit about the Pegasus. Why did you guys choose the Pegasus?
Oh, it's a wonderful symbol for flying. In fact, let me go to the website. There was a wonderful poem we found associated with it, which is on
yes,
the website.
Yes, I got it here. Allow me to read it for you. The author's unknown.
Why don't you read it?
I will read your Pegasus poem. I got to do this because, you know, this is the Odd Newfoundland, and I tend to pick up the oddest parts of your work.
That's
what I do.
No, that's good.
Through time clouds I fly to days gone by. Physical, limited, are all left behind. The future and past all in my grasp, for Pegasus shows me the keys in my mind. Horse of poetry, light, inspirational height. Your companion I'll be. New lands shall I see. Nice.
Yeah. And the whole thing, Pegasus, is mysterious enough. And I want you, and I'm sure you noticed it, but notice Pegasus's eye is a symbol psi.
Yes.
And psi not only stands, you know, psi is another synonym for like psychic, paranormal, I suppose. I don't like the word paranormal because all of this is quite normal, thank you. But it's also, psi is also the symbol used universally in quantum mechanics for these probabilistic possible states before they come into consciousness. And that's the universe of collective consciousness contains all of that stuff. And we get to play out just one of them that comes into our consciousness one at a time. Comes into my consciousness, comes into your consciousness. But we're all connected through this UCC, the Universal Collective Consciousness. It's kind of remarkable, actually. It's amazing.
Thing that I find remarkable as well is that you guys actually have some really nice examples on the website of RV and ARV. But, you know, I got to think that the man behind this has probably seen some very staggering, just shocking. I can't really say shocking, though, because to you, I know this is second nature. But I bet you've got some pretty amazing examples of remote viewing that you have documented over the years. And I think it'd be a real treat to get to the meat and potatoes of what you do. Kind of lift the curtain, shall we say, of what's in front of APP. Marty, can you tell us maybe one or two anecdotes of some of just the most incredible examples of, remote viewing that you have seen and you feel are really the real deal?
Well, we give conferences and workshops twice a year. Last June, and this was in Las Vegas, there's a newbie. You know, we've all heard of beginner's luck. With precognition, and this is on our website someplace, we have all, as you said, all kinds of examples So many of them are ridiculous, but they're all precognitive. This guy, a brand newbie, his wife had to drag him here. He really did not want to come. Okay, but she dragged him. He came. His very first session, and we did binary, and we wager on over-under just because it's like a 50-50 chance. And we are supposed to choose the photograph you're going to be shown after the game. So you describe it before the game, and there are two choices, one for over, one for under. And over under, there's a line set by the sports book guys, which is the total score. He drew a transcript, had a train on it. It was only after his transcript and the other, we had about 60 people there, 50, 60 people there. They all drew their transcripts as well. Only after the transcripts were drawn, we then randomly had someone from the audience randomly choose an envelope. And in that envelope were two pictures. One was of this train with the grating the train has, a track. I don't even remember what the other one was, but several people got the train. He nailed it so much it was kind of amazing. So already it was precognitive. Because it wasn't just a train, it was like that train. There were some very specific things on that train. So it was precognitive in that that was chosen randomly. But then that turned out to be what we call the side. It was actually associated with over and over one. So that's one example. Let me give you another example, and that's precognition, okay? Another, when you talk about a remarkable example, another one was done in the military. It wasn't exactly precognition, but close because everybody was blind to it. The CIA, this was done by Joe McMonagle, who's probably the best remote viewer in the world. So he worked in the military for, 20 years or something like that. And the CIA had this site where the Soviets were bringing lots of material in, lots of material out. It was highly protected. They had done the highest level of security on it. So the CIA knew there was something going on there. And so as a last resort, they go to remote viewing. There are a lot of people who just still don't accept this. And in the agencies, there were plenty of skeptics. They give this to Joe McMonagle. He comes back and says they are building the biggest submarine I've ever seen. They had their previous one next to it, and this was much, much larger than that submarine. He drew some sketches of it. The CIA thought he was crazy. He actually got angry at them and says, well, they're going to launch this thing on such and such a date, give or take. Well, they said it's not even that close to the water. Well, I can't remember exactly how far it was, but within a week of that date, they dug a trench from the Baltic Sea. Again, I don't remember the exact details. I haven't thought of this story for a long time, but they dug a big trench and launched their, I like to call it a boomer, but it's got another name. Their large submarine, with all the missiles and everything that was still around, I guess, with the Cold War and everything. But that is still by far the largest submarine around. And he nailed it with remote viewing. Period. And how did he do that? Well, in my opinion, he did it. A, there were conscious people who were working on it in there. So they put information down in the universe of collective consciousness. Plus, imagine all the excitement when it was actually lost. The CIA actually had a satellite overhead, so they were able to watch the launch. Anyway, that's another rather fantastic story, and there are literally thousands of them like that. Plus, if you come to our website, appliedprecog.com, we have a whole tab there that's called RV, ARV examples. So
And it'll be very easy to get lost in those examples. They're really, really cool. Some of them are actually just wow. Like, it just blows your mind how they were done. And the fact that this was done in a controlled environment, it gives me hope to know that there's people out there who are doing all the right things when it comes to, well, more taboo subjects. Two side notes. Number one, guys, the website you want to check Marty's wonderful work on and a lot of other people's wonderful work on is, once again, www.appliedprecog.com. Second side note is, those submarines you were talking about, I'm pretty sure they're called ballistic missile submarines. They're gigantic, and they're massive. Absolutely massive submarines. Okay. Yeah. Marty, thank you so very, very much for coming on the Odd to Newfoundland Paranormal Podcast. I think what you're doing is just fantastic. I know the people out there are going to jump on there and become a supporter of what you do. Lots of people listen to my podcast. You know, get this. You guys could even take, you know, part in these experiments in a way. Because I noticed there's this thing called become a paid precogger. So what is all this about, Marty? I got to ask you. We got to do a little bit of business here for you. Help you support your work.
Okay, that would be really good.
Yeah.
Actually, they can become an active member and become part of groups and learn how to do this. Because we give all kinds of webinars. There are a bunch of free past webinars on there. That's one of the tabs for free. If they come here, there's a place where they can contact us. And it's very obvious how to become a member. Once you contact us, you ask to become a member, you're a free member. If you want to become a paid member, then you can join more than one group. So you can do multiple predictions in a week rather than just one. Also, we have this series, which has now become quite well known. We call it a talk with series, but it's also video. We use Zoom, and we have some of the top people in the field talk. This Joe McMonagle I was talking about, he comes. Dean Radin, who wrote the book The Conscious Universe. And we have psychics on. We have people who do psychokinesis on, and they give 2 hour or so talks with our Talk With series. There you do have to become a paid member. And let me just throw out one last thing, because I do hope not only will they come here, but they'll play with it and actually join one of the groups. One of the things which is pretty amazing, like this beginner luck guy who is now still with us and doing well, most people don't know if they're precognitive or not. They just never thought that way, though some of you may have. Here's a way to not only find out, but we keep statistics on each individual viewer. And if you become good enough on our 50-50 proposition things, if you get up to like 65% for 25 or so predictions, that becomes statistically significant. We'll put you into a Precog Pro program where you can actually earn money. Eventually, if I look to the paradigm shift when precognition, life after death, all of that becomes common, we're accepting that, there are going to be precoggers out there who are going to be making their living doing predictions on financial instruments, doing predictions on, you know, what's the next best business to go into for venture capitalists. It's going to be a very different world. And frankly, we're looking for people who have precog talent.
There you have it, folks. Do you think you got what it takes to be a precogger? Check it out at appliedprecog.com. Marty Rosenblatt, thank you so very much for being a guest on the Odd to Newfoundland Paranormal Podcast.
Truly my pleasure, John.
Well, the time to say goodbye is upon us. But don't worry, you can keep track of the Odd to Newfoundland Paranormal Podcast very easily. It's available on Stitcher, iTunes, Podbean, and TuneIn Radio. Just look for the Odd to Newfoundland Paranormal Podcast banner. Of course, if you'd like to keep up to date, you can always check out the Odd to Newfoundland Paranormal Podcast Facebook page, drop a like, and every single time a new show goes up, you'll be notified. You can also follow me, John Mallard, on Twitter, at O-D-D-T-O-N-F-L-D. That's Odd to Newfoundland. From the oldest city in North America, I bid you adieu. From the Odd to Newfoundland Paranormal Podcast.